Love this podcast? Support this show through the supporter feature from Acast. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news ad free. That's amazon.com/news ad free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Attention, collectors of vinyl. Have you ever gone into a record store and felt overwhelmed by all the unfamiliar options? Are you frustrated by the constantly increasing prices of classic rock staples? Do you avoid streaming music or long for the days when music was recommended to you by a friend instead of an algorithm? If the answer to any of these questions is yes, then check out I'd Buy That for a Dollar, a podcast about inexpensive, common, and underappreciated records that are waiting to be rediscovered. Each week, hosts Sean, Jeremy, and Peter discuss an album and the artist's history. Previous episodes include selections by the Isley Brothers, the Carpenters, the Doobie Brothers, and Donna Summer, among others. Become a bargain bin pro and impress all your friends with cool music trivia. Listen to I'd Buy That for a Dollar wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks for listening to Creative Control. While I have you here, please consider supporting Youth Empowerment and Support Services, otherwise known as YES. Based in Edmonton, Alberta, YES provides immediate and low-barrier overnight and day shelter, temporary supportive housing, and individualized wraparound supports for young people aged 15 to 24. They work collaboratively within a network of care focused on the prevention of youth homelessness by providing youth with the necessary supports to stabilize their housing, improve their well-being, build life skills, connect with community, and avoid re-entry into homelessness. Learn more about how to donate or otherwise support YES by visiting yess.org.
Hey, this is Nicole calling from Hamilton, and I needed to let everyone know that I really proudly support Vish and Creative Control. I have for many years, I will for many more, as long as he keeps delivering these amazing interview podcasts. When you hear one of Vish's interviews, you think he's known this guest for years, they're good friends. But the truth is, he approaches every interview, whether it's sort of up-and-coming indie artists or established icons or like famous, intimidating comedians with a really deep, genuine curiosity, so he's never met this person, and the same really warm candor, as though he's known them forever. I think it really lends to a great chat, no matter who he's talking to, and for that reason, I think you should throw Vish, like what, $1 a month? He's got jokes. The jokes make it worth it. Support Creative Control on Patreon.
To make your flexible monthly donation to Creative Control, please visit patreon.com/creativecontrol today. I'm Visha's wife, and remember, when you name a dog Janet or Timothy, you are dragging humanity down just a little bit.
Leanne Bidasamose Simpson is an inspiring and prolific Machisa Geek Anishinaabe author, scholar, writer, advocate, and musician based in Peterborough, Ontario. A member of the Alderville First Nation, Simpson's album Theory of Ice was released by You've Changed Records in March 2021 and was one of 10 Canadian albums shortlisted for the Polaris Music Prize. Simpson has also authored 7 critically acclaimed and essential books, including the nonfiction A Short History of the Blockade and the novel Nopaming, A Cure for White Ladies, both of which we discussed when she was last on this show. On June 14th, 2022, Knopf Canada published the national nonfiction bestseller Rehearsals for Living, a dialogue about parallels between Black and Indigenous lived experiences and perspectives, framed as intimate, insightful letters exchanged by Simpson and her dear friend, the award-winning writer Robin Maynard. Leanne and I reconnected for an in-depth conversation about things like the fluidity of language and the validity of different pronunciations of her own name, how she first encountered Robin Maynard and how the idea for Rehearsals for Living evolved, parenting and pedagogy, the fact that there seem to be a lot more coups or attempted coups these days, and what that might mean generally, Canada's attempts to whitewash its role in the oppression of Indigenous and Black people, our shared experiences with and love for the retired University of Guelph Black History professor Dr. Clarence J. Munford, true abolition and hope, future plans, and much more. A part of the Entertainment One Network with the support of listeners like you who follow and subscribe to this podcast and spread the word about it and make flexible monthly donations at patreon.com/creativecontrol, which is the primary source of revenue for all the work that goes into making this podcast. Again, you can learn more about how to financially support the show at patreon.com/creativecontrol. Plus in-kind support from Pizza Trocadero, The Bookshelf, and Planet Bean Coffee, respectively, in Guelph, Ontario, and Granddad's Donuts in Hamilton, Ontario. This is episode 742 of Creative Control, featuring the brilliant and kind Leanne Bidasamose Simpson with your host, me, Vish Khanna. Hi, Leanne. How's it going?
Hi, Vish. It's going well. How are you doing?
I'm well, thank you. I'm very well. Where in the world are you today?
I'm in Peterborough, Ontario today.
Ah, very nice. This is your long-time home. How long have you been in Peterborough?
This is my long-time home. I've been here since, I think, about 2000.
So, wow.
Yeah, over 20 years.
I can't recall. Have you spent considerable amounts of time living elsewhere? I know you travel a lot, but have you lived anywhere else since you settled in Peterborough?
Not since I've settled in Peterborough. I spend a lot of time in Yellowknife, so that would be sort of the next place that I land quite a bit. But I moved quite a bit through my 20s, but since I've settled, I've been here.
Nice, nice. And what is the vibe in Peterborough for you today? I know you're a busy person. As we're speaking, I was just speaking to my father early this morning, and he suggested he's in Ontario, far away from you in a sense. He is in Cambridge, Ontario. He said there's a big ice storm or something. Is that right?
That is the vibe of Ontario this morning. There's a big storm coming. It's like I'm looking on my phone. It's going to start snowing in the afternoon. And yeah, 20 centimeters for us. So, and that's a big area. It's going to be, yeah, so that's exciting.
that's the first big snowstorm of the year, 2022. Is that right?
We have snow on the ground now, and we've had a couple of, 10 centimeters, but I think there's a lot of hype with this one.
Yes. Yes. I've heard about it.
A lot of buildup.
Even here in Edmonton, I've heard about it, but beyond talking to my father, I saw on the social media and where people saying they're batting down the hatches and all that sort of stuff. All right. Well, are you able to hunker down? Are you able to stay in?
Yeah. I've just got a lot of Zooms. So unfortunately the weather isn't, I'm not going to get a snow day.
Yeah. That's the other weird part of this time since the pandemic, where we learned that some of us could do, those who are so privileged can do some of their work from their homes. But that's, you don't get the sick days anymore, the snow days. People are bending that, well, I'm home anyway. I can probably do that little bit of work, even though I'm feeling a little run down. Have you done that? Have you encountered that in your work? people just working through things they would normally be like, yeah, no, I'm taking the day off.
Yeah, there's certainly that pressure. I just remember, like, my best memories of being a kid is like listening to the radio at 7:45 and finding out that school was canceled for the day because it was a snow day.
Yeah.
Like the joy. And I feel badly for kids now, where it just means that they're online.
Yeah. I like the virtual parts in some ways because you can get things done. We've proven that. But yes, there's no boundaries, if you will. And that's maybe on us. I try to have personal boundaries and say, yeah, no, I'm not doing this now. This is my time with my family or this or that. But it's anyway, it's hard. I'm just happy you're back on the show and we get to talk about this momentous book that you wrote with Robin Maynard. So we'll get into that in a moment. One quick bit of business. Since we've last spoken, I've encountered you doing where it came to my attention actually the most was when you were nominated for the Polaris Music Prize. By the way, belated congratulations on that nomination for what it's worth.
Thank you.
Yes. But I heard you actually identify yourself and pronounce your name in a way that I hadn't heard it pronounced before, because you've, as I mentioned, we've spoken many times. I've always asked you how to sort of pronounce your full name. Something has, in my view anyway, something had changed about the pronunciation. Am I wrong about this? Was I wrong this whole time? Can you explain what's going on in terms of how you're saying your full name these days?
Yeah, so I don't think anyone has ever asked me this, and so I feel like I'm just going to tell the whole story. So
sure.
When I was living in Winnipeg, I didn't have an Anishinaabe name, and I was working with an elder from Shoal Lake named Robin Green, who has now passed on, and he gave me this name in a sweat lodge, and he had a vision in the naming ceremony of a woman walking towards the earth from the moon. Mm. And that's culturally significant because the moon is something that takes care of women and children and two-spirit folks. And so he wrote down the way that folks see it spelled on this yellow sticky note, which I still have, and he gave it to me, and it was sort of his phonetic pronunciation of the word. And so Bitasimusak was how I was pronouncing it, and I am a horrible, horrible, horrible language speaker. I've taken lessons for years. I've had tutors. I'm not good at it. And then when I moved back home, I would be saying this name, and elders here were like, what? Like, what is, like, they didn't understand. And so over the years, I sort of kept to that pronunciation. It's a different dialect where I live in the East. So we speak differently. We drop a lot of syllables. And then I'm a bad pronouncer of Anishinaabe Moin. And I eventually just did a recording of Doug Williams, who's the elder that I worked with, who has also passed away. And he said it in our dialect, and it was Bidasmuse. And so both are correct, and both are fine. And I think now, as I'm getting older, every time I look at the word, I think of that sticky note that Robin Green wrote on it. And every time I say Bidasmuse, I think of sitting in the truck with Doug, with my iPhone, being like, I keep pronouncing this wrong. You got to teach me this. So there are two sort of really cherished memories that I have. And that's the story of my name.
I appreciate this very much, and I thank you for it. I will tell you that selfishly and self-consciously, I was like, oh no, I have been saying it wrong, even though then I was like, wait a minute, but I always ask Leanne how to pronounce it, and that's what she told me, and then I heard this different pronunciation. You self-effacingly describe yourself as a terrible pronouncer, I suppose is the word, but you also hit upon something that I've come across a few times. There are different and distinctive dialectical pronunciations in a lot of languages, actually, but that's something we should consider, I think. I've had these conversations with people like the folks in the band, and see, I might say this incorrect, so to speak, but Ombigize. And they mm-hmm. suggested, yeah, no, there's, we don't even know. Like we're still learning. We have been put in this very horrible position where our language and our culture has been erased to such an extent that we're trying to learn it. And we're feeling self-conscious that we're stumbling, but at the same time being told by elders, it's okay. These things are somewhat fluid. So in any case, so what I'm getting at is that's what you're hitting upon too. Like there can be multiple yeah. pronunciations for the same word. And that's what you're discovering as you delve into your culture?
Yeah, there's lots of diversity in the way things are pronounced because Anishinaabe people were spread out on the land. And Doug used to talk about how different families had different ways of speaking because they were spending long periods of time more isolated, more socially distanced. He used to talk about how families from Alderville, which is the place that I'm a status Indian and a band member of, used to sing the language. And so there's a lot of diversity. There's also, I also am not good at pronouncing and the language. And this came to a fore during the pandemic when I was my mom and my two sisters, Ansley and Shannon, and my daughter, Minwe, and I were all taking online language classes at Alderville, but on Zoom with our teacher, Melody Crow. Mm. And so my daughter is a teenager, and I've done lots of language work in the community with her as part of a language nest. So she grew up hearing it to a greater degree than I did. And then taking these language classes, I would be like thinking I was doing a great job. And she would be texting me, Mom, like you have the worst English accent. Like try and listen to the teacher. I'm so embarrassed. Oh. I'm so embarrassed. So I'm like, yeah. Okay, I'm not as good as I think.
Well, I mean, it's.
So it was humble. It was a beautiful kind of thing to be having the Zoom language. It was a great pandemic kind of memory to be online with my mom, like have three generations of people trying to learn the language. And you could hear through the generations, Minwe actually sounds the best out of all of us. So that's a beautiful thing.
There's a license to make mistakes in the process of learning things, wouldn't you say? I mean, isn't that something we should accept?
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
For sure, especially with language learning when there's a lot of violence that people, families, elders have gone through in terms of residential schools and the Indian Act. And so I think that creating these kind of nurturing environments where it's fine to make mistakes and it's really, really important to try and do your best is really important as well.
I wonder if that's at least a subtextual aspect of your pedagogical approach overall. Because I feel like if I generalize about the work you've done and been doing for all these years, and I encounter this in my day job all the time where people, when you try to educate certain people about topics that are potentially sensitive to them or sensitive in general or that make them uncomfortable, their knee-jerk reaction can be to lash out at the person educating them, to lash out because I think they feel guilt and I think they feel self-conscious that they don't know things or they didn't know the plight of someone. And certainly mm-hmm. cultural differences, when they're pointed out, can be an inflammatory thing depending on how you're coming to it. Like, I don't know what I'm getting at right now, but you invoked your daughter there. And when I think of this beautiful new book, Rehearsals for Living, it definitely seems to have a pedagogical aspect, an educational aspect. And I can see some people accepting this for what it is, but I can also see some people not ignore it, but we're not denigrated even. I'm not sure what the word I'm looking for, but you know where I'm coming from? There is an impulse to sort of feel badly without just processing the information and the facts for what they are. Do you know where I'm coming from there? Have you encountered that as you've taught and tried to impart wisdom to people who may not be ready for it, if you will?
You know, I think as you're talking, I thought the first thing I thought of was parenting. And I thought of like all the kinds of things as a parent you want to teach your children and how oftentimes you get that immediate backlash.
Yeah.
My kids are like, when they were little, they were like, that's our teacher voice. And so I think in thinking about parenting, I figured out kind of ways where you set up situations, you set up learning situations where they don't know they're learning, where there's just a lot of joy and there's a lot of laughter and they're discovering and they have kind of some self-determination, but they're still at the end of the day kind of coming to the thing that you wanted them to figure out, but they've explored it and they've made it their own. And that side of pedagogy, I think, made parenting a lot more fun for our family.
Yeah.
But also then I was like, you know what, when you set up situations and people kind of find the information on their own, that can be a powerful pedagogical kind of intervention.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I think there is just this thing floating in the air as people learn things that I think people want to feel like they're more informed than they are. And when they discover they're not, when someone says, well, no, the real history is this or the real information is this, they have this knee-jerk reaction that their intelligence is being attacked. So anyway, I feel like that's floating around in the air quite a bit in this, particularly in this pandemic era, which has been very fractured and overly politicized and all the buzzwords I can think of right now. But I when I see the anger, I feel like it's people who are both, they feel like they've been made to feel ignorant, but I also think they're afraid of the things they don't know. Does that make sense?
I'm thinking just about myself here, and I'm thinking there's sometimes like issues come up in the world. Like example from this week is Peru. And there's all these protests going on in Peru. And I'm like, I feel like I've let this slide. Like I need to spend some time and sort through what's happening here. And so I feel like if you care about what's going on in the world, I think you kind of have to every day get up and engage in this sort of education process, particularly if you're coming from kind of an anti-colonial perspective or a perspective that you might not get in the mainstream media. And so I learned that. I think that there's a part in Rehearsals for Living where Robin talks about getting up every morning and kind of re-educating yourself. And that's, I think, such a powerful practice, because when I'm constantly doing that and I encounter folks that have, you know, gone through the Canadian school system, have degrees from universities and don't know the first thing about whose territory they're living in or anything about my people. And I find that a lot of times that group of folks is encountering my work not through books but through music. I know also what that feels like. And I also know what that feels like to, as a practice, kind of commit to working through that and always making my world bigger instead of smaller.
You know, one of the interesting aspects of this particular time is that people have become so outspoken that they're leaning on revolution. I mean, depending on your political stripe and how you feel about how certain things have been implemented, there's a lot of like coups in the air, regime change beyond the democratic way of going about things, elections and whatnot. That seems to be more in the air these days. And I'm not suggesting, well, there's revolution in this book of yours too. Do you have like I say, I think this is happening whether you lean right or left, depending on who's in power. There's just this feeling that whatever has been going on isn't working. It needs to change. And people are trying to mobilize. Literally, I don't know, 10 years ago, if I was like, there's coups all the time, we would be like, what are you talking about? But I mean, every week, there's some country, it seems to me, some nation is in, or nation state or whatever, they're enduring this. And it's very telling, I think, of how unhappy people are. Anyway, yeah. And like I say, I think that's a thread in this book, like in your new book, things need to change in a very, what some would call radical way. Does that resonate with you? Like this feeling that everything needs to change and be different is really hitting home. I don't know if this is a pandemic era realization or what. What do you think?
Well, I think that there's been this intensification of fascism. On the weekend in Peterborough, there was a demonstration of 400 people the same group of people that were sort of protesting the mandates and that were involved in the trucker convoy, the fuck Trudeau sort of people gathered. And that was like I hadn't thought of the truckers convoy for a while, right? We're coming up on sort of the year anniversary. So I think there's been this tremendous sort of lots of fascism in the US and in Canada and in Europe, kind of resurgence of that. There's also been, I think during the pandemic, as a result of the murder of George Floyd and hundreds of years of organizing, this kind of black summer of black revolt that we talk about in the book. I think if we look more globally, while there's sort of this intensification of fascism in Europe and North America, there's also all these kinds of leftist governments and happening in the global South. And then I think we've got, you know, this labor. I've been thinking a lot about the labor movement we've had, I was just in New York City, the new school was on strike. Mm-hmm. The University of California system was on strike. The railway workers in the U.S. were on strike. We had a teacher's strike in Ontario. So I think there's a lot of unrest and there's coups are in the air.
I don't know how else to put it. It's also projection. The fascists calling the non-fascists fascists, like just distorting everything. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Anyway, it's just a very complicated time. And I think there are some solutions floating around in this book. And I think we should get to it. And I want to ask you, first of all, if I haven't already, congratulations on this book, Rehearsals for Living. I hope you're very proud of it.
Thank you. Yeah, it was a wonderful sort of letter writing project for Robin and I during the early days of the pandemic.
Yeah. Yeah. I want to get to the actual structure in a moment and potentially get you to, sort of summarize it for those who haven't yet read it, so I don't do a clumsy job of doing it. I've alluded to it a few times now, but let's first of all get to your dynamic with Robin. How did you first encounter Robin via her work, or as I can tell now that you're quite close as friends, but how did you first encounter Robin Maynard?
I first met Robin in Montreal on Jojaga on Ganagihaga territory in maybe 2017, and her book Policing Black Lives had just come out, and I was promoting a book called As We Have Always Done, and I was doing a launch in Montreal, and whoever was organizing the launch asked me who I kind of wanted to be in conversation with, and I immediately thought of Robin because the two books in our work at that time seemed to me to be very linked. Mm. And I would have written a different book had Policing Black Lives sort of come out a couple of years earlier. I would have brought the two books into conversation. So we met on stage in Montreal, and we had this, I remember, beautiful, amazing conversation about kind of our two books. And I think that was sort of the beginnings. That was where the seeds were planted. Mm. And then as part of my work at the Dachenta Center for Research and Learning in Yellowknife Dene territory, outside of Yellowknife in the NWT, I was working with some of my colleagues there, and we were talking about having an on-the-land solidarity gathering with Black and Brown and Indigenous activists. And so we brought this group in March. And so it's still very hardcore winter, like Edmonton, in March. Yeah. It's not like Sugarbush time in Ontario. We brought this group of people up. We took them out on snowmobiles out onto the big lake. And we just shared food. We shared stories. We set a fish net and fished it and shared fish. And just had these kind of two or three days where we were sharing our experiences and getting to know each other. But in a very Dene sort of context with elders and with the land. Yeah. And we had planned sort of from that gathering to kind of keep expanding that work. But those plans got truncated by the pandemic. And so Robin, I think, as a way of extending some of the work that we had started there in the fall of 2019, wrote me that first letter. Hmm. And it was I mean, it's a tremendous letter. It's the kind of letter that you can kind of sit down with a coffee one morning and respond to. I had to read things. I had to think through things. Yeah. And so it took me a while to be able to write that second letter back. And by the time I wrote the second letter back, we were into the first stay-at-home order.
Yeah.
So I suddenly had tons of time on my hands. And at that point, this wasn't a book. This was just us trying to think through some of the issues that we were encountering between Black and Indigenous people in Canada at that time. And we didn't have any intention of making this book. It was just this kind of pandemic became kind of a pandemic project of writing back and forth and learning from each other, just kind of for ourselves.
I appreciate that. It's somewhat, I mean, it doesn't come across as happenstance. The letters seem very researched. To call them letters is an interesting distinction. I know they are, but that's fascinating itself. And I want to get to the structure and how this all came about in a moment. But you said something there about policing Black lives that stuck out for me, that if you had read that before you'd written your book would have been different. Robin was on the show to talk about that book, and I read that book, and it also impacted me. But what was it exactly about Robin's book that altered you so much? It's referenced many times in this book. You each reference each other's works and how they've impacted each of you. But can you speak to that? What was it about Robin's book in particular that altered you? Is that the wrong word? I feel like it did. It altered you. Is that fair?
Yeah, I think that's fair. Yeah. I think in Canada, we don't hear, we don't learn in school about the transatlantic slave trade. We don't learn about the afterlives of slavery. We don't learn about anti-Blackness.
No.
As sort of a foundational force in the formation of the country. And so
it's quite the opposite, actually. We're viewed as this, Canada is viewed as was viewed as a safe haven, whereas it's quite the opposite for people fleeing America, slaves fleeing America, right? We've heard about the Underground Railroad. And that makes us come across as a country superior. But as you mentioned, and I didn't mean to cut you off, the historical record tells us something far different. Is that fair?
Yeah, that's fair. The historical record tells us something like quite different. And the Black community tells us something quite different. Yeah. And so there's this, you're right, Canada has this belief that it's exceptional and that it wasn't a participant in this. And the only time we hear about Canada in relation to the transatlantic slave trade is around the Underground Railway. So I think what policing Black lives in this kind of rigorous and meticulous way is it destroys that Canadian exceptionalism with this like volcano of evidence that's speaking otherwise. And it's all in kind of this one place in this one book. And that's very powerful. And so I think a lot of my work up until Policing Black Lives had been very focused on Anishinaabe things, very focused on Indigenous things, because I think that's where I was, that's where my community was. I needed to spend kind of 20 years learning how to think through these things from an Anishinaabe perspective. And then while I was doing that and figuring out that, oh, like deep relationality and relationships are really important in Anishinaabe thought, land is really important in Anishinaabe thought. But then when you start to think of ecosystems, when you start to think of water, when you start to think of relationships, you can't just kind of stay in your own little corner of the world for very long, because you recognize everything is related and there's a whole system. And so my work sort of, and you can start to see that shift, I think, in as we have always done, I'm starting to look into a more international orientation. And I think that that's what Policing Black Lives did for me. It was like, this country is founded on two genocides, and they're linked and they're different and the experiences are different. But I'm interested in how those things are linked. And I think that's what Robin and I, that's at least one of the things I was exploring in rehearsals for a living.
I think some of us have a sense memory of when we discovered something we believed is actually bullshit. I gather from what you're saying in terms of how policing Black lives resonated with you, there's a chance it was a parallel sensation or a similar sensation, I should say, to perhaps when you discovered more about Canada's history with Indigenous people. I mean, on some level, on many levels, on a whole level, that must have been a very personal realization for you. Is it fair to say you had that similar sort of sensation reading Policing Black Lives? Like, oh my God, not only this is beyond cultural erasure, this is subjecting a whole history to the dustbin on purpose. Like, did you have that sort of same feeling?
I think for me, in sort of becoming politically aware as an Indigenous person, that it happened sort of in increments over the course of kind of my life. And then eventually, I think when I got maybe to university and started to be able to read people like Lee Miracle or Vine Deloria Jr., start to be able to have that critique. For me, when I was at the University of Guelph, I was in biology, but I took Black history courses from Clarence Munford.
One of my favorite, he was absolutely one of my favorite professors.
He was my favorite professor as well. And that was actually the first time I was like, holy shit, I don't know anything about anything.
The books you have in university, you retain as many of them. I can't speak for everyone. I've retained as many of them as I can, but some prove to feel more useful than others, if you will. And when you're a poor student, and there's an opportunity to resell them to others so they can use them, you do it. But I've kept every single one of the books that Professor Munford assigned us, like White Violence, Black Response, and Global Rift, and all these books that I don't know that I'll read them again necessarily. They're quite dense, but I felt like I needed to keep them. Sorry, a little aside there.
That's so funny. Yeah. Because I've carted those books around Global Rift, White Violence, Black Response, and Black Reconstructionism by Du Bois. I've carted those around from Guelph to Sackville, New Brunswick, to Thunder Bay, to like Winnipeg, to Peterborough. Like those are the three books that are the most.
Absolutely. I have every single one he assigned. I have I've done the same. I haven't had to cart them as far as you, but at least between Guelph and Guelph, Cambridge, and Edmonton. Yes, they've moved with me. So I just want to say, it's interesting. We encounter these figures in our lives, and it may not seem consequential at the time in some ways. You know, for university students, you're signing up. So history classes were electives for me. I was in English. But I just took every single one. Yeah. He also had a pretty remarkable and generous grading system where you would do it. I don't know if this was your experience, but he would give you a multiple choice exams and midterms and tests. And then you had the opportunity to increase your grade by writing a more fulsome essay around the subject matter. So you could get 85% on your exam. But if you wrote an essay, you would get, like in some cases, I don't know how he got away with this, but you could get 105%. Or something like it was really interesting, but he was just trying to encourage you to engage more for credit. And sorry, this is really an aside, but I like that we have this kinship with Professor Munford because I really valued that experience and the knowledge I had to me, like the what he taught. I guess the parallel is that was a revelation for me. All of his courses were like, holy shit. I did not know this. No one taught me this in high school. So, sorry, that's where I was coming from.
Yeah, no, I think that I feel like this was a really, this is a really beautiful creative control moment because I feel like when I got up this morning, this is not what I thought I was going to be talking about. But yeah, for me as well. And I feel like that experience was also, that changed my life. And I think that it's taken me a while to go back and revisit everything that I learned from that guy. Yeah. But that's also something that is a precursor, I think, to our Rehearsals for Living.
Yeah, absolutely. So you say you exchanged letters, and that is a For some, they'll be like, letters? That's so old-timey. Were you physically writing each other letters or were they emails? I don't mean to get too in the weeds with it, but I'm just curious because they're very... If you were to handwrite this stuff, I mean, it would be... I don't even know where I'm going with this, but it just seemed like it would be like a lot of work. What form did these letters take, literally?
They were emails. They were emails for sure.
Okay.
And yeah, no, they were not old.
Can you,
they were not like,
can you imagine?
Footnote 63.
Okay, so you started an email correspondence with no sense of where it might go. I assume either of you might have thought, well, this could be fodder for something, but probably needs to be more formalized. Or did it start to gradually feel like, no, this correspondence on its own, this kind of dialogue... Because what it does, I'll tell you experientially reading it, is you realize this is what's missing. This kind of dialogue between groups who may not realize that they are experiencing some of the same things when you talk about land usage. And I, you know, there's a point in the book where I can't recall if it's you or Robin are just trying to draw parallels between the experience of Black people in North America and Indigenous people in Canada and in North America, I should say. And the parallels between reservations and segregation, I couldn't help but think of projects in America mm-hmm. where people are segregated to the point where some nefarious leadership has said, we'll just put all of you here. You fend for yourselves here. And we will live separately from you. All I'm getting at is, was your hope that the form of letters, an exchange of ideas between people who may not realize they're leading very similar lives, will encourage others to have such dialogue and find connections with groups that they may not have thought they had connections with?
Yeah, so Robin and I are just doing this kind of little geek project for ourselves and for our own learning.
Yeah.
And it's not on my radar at all that anyone else would ever read these letters. Mm. And she goes out for a walk in the summer after we have about five or six with Dion Brand, and she's telling Dion's like, what are you doing? Like, what does your day look like?
Yeah.
And Robin starts explaining these letters in this project, and Dion is like, I want to see that.
Hmm.
And, you know, Dion's like the best writer
yes.
in the world. Yes. And so when she says she wants to see something, we're like, oh my God. Yeah. So sure, we'll share this project with her. And she was the one that was like, this is a book and the work that these letters are doing is really, really important. Mm. So without that, I don't know, we might have eventually made it into a zine or something, or I don't know that we would have ever gotten to a book. But what happened was, I think you're right. I think the work that kind of movements and people maybe need to do is that kind of work of building relationships. And there's an intimacy to building relationships. And the letters, as much as they're geeky and they're academic and there's footnotes and there's readings, there is an intimacy that I think allowed us to, in a way that was, I hope, filled with humility and not necessarily knowing, we're sort of educating each other and thinking through together in the book, that became, as we've kind of toured the book and engaged with audiences, seems to be very something that's very important, that a lot of people found engaging, and that was almost a... We were in New York at Columbia last week, and my friend Audra Simpson was talking about how it was kind of an expression of Indigenous diplomacy mm. and Black diplomacy, and how we're sort of working together. So I mean, at one point we thought of, let's just make this an academic book and like cut out the intimacy and cut out the dear Robin and dear Leanne's, and maybe it'll be taken more seriously because I was worried that you've got to a Black woman and an Indigenous woman. You know, I didn't want the book to be in the cookbook section, in the recipe section. I was like, I think there's some important things happening here.
Yeah.
And we talked through it, and we talked through it with Lynn Henry, who is our editor, and Dion, and we decided to keep that letter writing structure. And I'm really, really glad we did. That's because I think I didn't realize at the time the work that form was doing. And I think you're right. These are the kinds of conversations that we need to have with each other.
It's very impactful and accessible in this regard because, as I alluded to earlier, you both invoke your children in terms of how they teach you things, and you're trying to teach them things and show them videos and all sorts of things that pertain to the subject matter at hand. So it doesn't seem, sometimes in letter writing, there is intimacy. And it, like you said, you probably were writing thinking no one else would read them. But I gather that might have, that approach might have evolved as you went. Cause at some point I did find myself thinking that you were speaking outwardly more. The premise is that you're speaking to each other, but this is not just for you anymore. It's for your children. It's for people like me. It's for people who might gain some insight into the parallels of your peoples. Does that make sense? Did your tone start to shift a little bit, become a little more external?
I think that at the point where we decide to make this into a book, then we started to edit the letters, because you don't, when you're just writing letters back and forth, you don't, after you send them, you don't edit them, right?
No, like, of course not. Yeah.
You move on to the next letter. Yeah. And so one of the things I think that we were doing is going back and thinking about how different groups of people who are reading, how the reader was going to experience this. And so there is one part that I really remember around the Indian Act, where I know Robin knows about the Indian Act, but the editors were picking up on, what if you have a reader that doesn't know what Robin knows?
Yes.
Like, can you put more in there so that they have the same sort of context? So there was things like that that I think are ethically and responsible in terms of thinking about, like, an audience or kind of readers from different cultures and from different places encountering the work and what their experience is going to be.
Yeah. So this phrase, rehearsals for living, I think should be homed in on. If you can help the listeners here and myself explain where that phrase comes from. And then also, I will clumsily suggest it is tied to notions of abolition that you two are discussing in this book. So yeah, the two things are, can you talk a little bit about this expression? And the second, what do you feel like you learned the most from this experience of exchanging letters with Robin? And what do you suppose those of us reading this and those, this seems to me a book that will resonate throughout time. I feel like even as you're writing to each other, there's a moment where one of you, I think it's you, Leanne, says, well, we were right. We were right about the pandemic. Everything we've talked about has come to pass. And I've had these conversations with you before where I feel like there's a lot of prescience. Well, it's prescience, but I think we ignore people like you and Robin who are quietly writing. It's quiet because it's a book maybe, but you do all sorts of engagements, but you end up being right is where I'm coming from. And so as much as I hear, I can see some people bristling at the conclusions I think that you've both gotten to, I think you're right in terms of what abolition truly means. Anyway, I'm sorry, I've muddled this question. Can you talk a little bit about this expression, rehearsals for living? And then also what you took away from this experience and maybe what you hope others might.
Yeah, so the title comes from the work of Ruth Wilson Gilmore. And I think the line in her work is, abolition is life in rehearsals. And
yes.
So we reached out to her and asked permission to use the title. It comes from this idea that I think in her work, that has a kind of a broad thinking through of abolition, that if you're going to build societies that don't have carceral systems, that don't have prisons, and you start to think through that, then you actually do have to change everything, and you have to build a completely different society. And so there's sort of a visioning and a dreaming, and I think a leveling up of our dreams and of our visions of a future beyond the circumstances that we're currently facing. From an Indigenous perspective, process is always really important. And when I think of how my ancestors lived, they would have got up every morning. They would have had to make everything. They were makers. They made their forms of transportation. They made their food system. They made their political system. They made their spirituality. They made the language. They made their clothing, their housing. They made everything. They were constantly engaged in creative practices in order to build the world. They didn't rely on sort of institutions or things that are already set up. It was people coming together on the land and making things.
Yeah.
And that, to me, is a really powerful way of living in the world. And I think artists and musicians and people involved in making culture are sort of enacting those practices to some degree in society. But I think they're a really important site of knowledge generation. So every time we come together on the land or at a protest or organizing and we do something, we learn something. And we generate sort of the knowledge and the theory that we need to start to dream and build these other worlds. So this idea of rehearsal seemed really, I don't know, it really resonated with me. It also resonated with me as a musician because, you know, when you make a record, the thing that I do the most is rehearse. And the thing that I love the most is actually rehearsals because the audience isn't there. You try different things, you figure things out. It's a generative sort of space where you're engaged in singing or saying or playing the same song over and over and over and over and over again. And for me, that kind of repetitive practice and even going on tour and doing the same show over and over and over and over and over again and learning how to struggle to stay in that present moment, even though it's something that you've done so many times, there's something that sort of feels like it's rewiring my brain. And that's something that I really missed because we didn't get to play Theory of Vice because it came out during the pandemic to the degree that we got to play Flight. And playing those songs and getting to know them inside out is something that's generative to me as a creative practice. So I liked this. I really liked the idea of the rehearsal as a practice. And it seemed like a really fitting sort of title for the book because it had this coming from abolition and Ruthie Wilson Gilmore, but then also these kind of other meanings and resonance for me as well.
Well, there's a very interesting section towards the end of the book where hope is invoked and what it means when you do the work you do and interviewers like me try to ask you, well, what does this all mean? Where do you think we can go? But I also like what you're saying about the invocation of rehearsal, because ostensibly what a rehearsal is trying something, actually trying something, not doing nothing, but actually trying something to see if it works and then refining it. So it's an interesting term for me, also coming from the arts. It's an interesting term for me to apply to the notion of abolition, because that sounds like a big thing. But it is something we can, like the ideas you both propose are things we could try. Is that a fair way of kind of assessing it?
I like this idea of almost like Miriam Kaba talks about how hope is an emotion, but hope is also a practice. And I think that's kind of what you're gesturing towards when you're thinking of a rehearsal. There's some kind of embedded hope in a rehearsal because you're doing something.
Yeah.
You're thinking that there's going to be a future. You're doing something, and that's hope, not necessarily as an emotion, but hope as a practice. And so, I think abolition can be overwhelming. Fascism can be overwhelming. The world right now is overwhelming, and you can feel paralyzed.
Yeah.
But I think it's important to move through that paralyzation and think of and do stuff.
Yeah.
And struggle and fight back. And I think when you do that and you start to do that with people, I think that that's a generative process. I think that that generates new questions. It generates some answers. It generates, it's a start. And I think that's important.
I like what you're saying about the possibility that reading this book or this book in itself is one antidote to that paralysis that we all see, and malaise and hopelessness that is floating in the air. Because it did instill me with hope, with feelings of like, oh yeah, why don't we just try that? Like, why can't we just try that? That seems to be a solution. And there's you both do a very good job of outlining how these kinds of approaches that you are describing could work or have worked historically. So I just want to tell you, in the few minutes we have left here, I want to tell you that I appreciate this book very much. I thank you both for writing it. What's next for you? I know Robin's not here, so I can't ask her the same question. But what's next for you, Leanne? Musically, in terms of other work you do, is there anything you want to talk about in the time we have left?
I'm sort of in that stage where I've got a few things kind of percolating. I'm trying a few things. I'm rehearsing a few things, but I don't know if they're good yet. I don't know where they're going, but I'm definitely writing. I'm hoping to make another record in the future.
Oh, great.
I'm hoping to be able to play Theory of Ice a little bit more. And yeah.
Okay. No, that's I understand where you're coming from. That malaise and uncertainty is definitely floating in the air, and I don't expect you to be exempt from that. I know you don't do a lot of you don't have a robust internet presence. Let's put it this way: if people want to learn more about you and your work, where can they go?
They can. I have two websites: leannesimpson.ca and leannesimpsonmusic.com, and.
Websites. That's robust. I retract what I said.
No one
has two websites. Good Lord. Okay. Sorry about that. Okay. So they can go there. I will link to things in the podcast description. Oh, anything else? Sorry, I cut you off. Anywhere else that you live online?
No, I think that's it.
It's sufficient. Two websites. Again, I think that's great. If we can go out, and oh, by the way, and this book, Rehearsals for Living, is out via NOF Canada, and people can go to penguinrandomhouse.ca for more info about that, or go to your local library, ask for them to put the book in the system there, or go to your local bookstore.
Yep. Go support those local independent bookstores for sure.
Yeah. Now, unusually, I have an author on the show who makes great records. Is there a song from Theory of Ice, perhaps, that we could go out on right now? And if so, can you pick it and tell us why it might fit or resonate with this conversation?
Yeah, for sure. Which
sorry to put you on the spot.
Breakup. Maybe Breakup would be good. Breakup is not about like a relationship breakup. It's about the breakup of a lake in the spring, like the breakup of the ice.
So
that's such a fantastical transformation that happens every year, and I think we've talked a lot about these sort of transformations in this conversation, so maybe that's a good one.
I agree. All right, from the album Polaris Music Prize shortlisted album Theory of Ice, this is Breakup. Leanne, I always love speaking with you. I hope you enjoyed this conversation, and thank you for all your work, and best of luck in the future. I hope we talk again soon.
Yeah, thank you for this conversation, and definitely we'll talk soon.
Over. the surface. There is euphonic rising and falling, orbits of dispossession and reattachment, achieving maximum density, 39 degrees Fahrenheit. You relax at the surface, spread apart.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news ad free. That's amazon.com/news ad free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
It's always such a great honor and thrill to have Leanne on this show. Thank you once again, Leanne, for being back on Creative Control. For those of you listening, this is the 742nd episode of Creative Control, which is part of the Entertainment One podcast network and is available wherever you get your podcasts pretty much. If you can't find an episode that you're looking for, or if you want to learn more about me and sign up for my monthly newsletter, please visit vishkhanna.com. You can also like Creative Control on Facebook or follow the show on Twitter. For now, at Vish Creative, or you can follow me directly on Twitter and on Instagram at Vish Khanna. Also, please visit patreon.com/creativecontrol to make a flexible monthly donation to sustain this podcast. $6 American or more a month grants you access to some exclusive content. You get the episodes earlier than everyone else, some bonus time with some of my guests, and archival audio as well from my personal archives, interviews I've done that preceded this podcast, all sorts of things. And also, if you're interested in receiving a Creative Control t-shirt as a nice little, you know, token of my appreciation, just message me on Patreon and I'll get you one while supplies last. It doesn't have to be $6 American a month. It could be lower than that. It can be higher than that. And the beauty of it really is you can adjust it at any time. Higher, lower, whatever suits you. Again, learn more at patreon.com/creativecontrol, and thanks in advance for your support. Speaking of thanks, I want to thank Pizza Trocadero, The Bookshelf, and Planet Bean Coffee in Guelph, Ontario, and Granddad's Donuts in Hamilton, Ontario, for their in-kind support for this show. Thanks, as always, to my friend Jim Guthrie for letting me use some music of his on this show. You can learn more about Jim, jimguthrie.org. And finally, thank you so much for listening to this chat with Leanne, and I hope you will pick up the book that she wrote with Robin, Rehearsals for a Living. It's really, really essential reading, and it's so beautifully put together. I hope we can. I conveyed that as much as I could during this conversation with Leanne. Thank you for subscribing to this podcast and following it, and for telling your friends about it and spreading the word. It means a lot. And that is it. I hope you're well, and I will talk to you very soon. Bye for now.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.